Good afternoon. Welcome to High Notes in week five of the 2017 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School. I'm Alan Fletcher, president of the festival and school, and I am joined on stage by composers Chris Theofanides and Daniel Kellogg. We are in the beautiful and historic PEPCA Auditorium of the Aspen Institute, and this is also being broadcast on Aspen Public Radio, the voice of music in Aspen, and also is available on podcast, which you can get from our website, www.aspenmusicfestival.com, and from wherever you get podcasts. So today we're going to talk about new music, some new music we're presenting this week, and also the compositional process, and also, I hope, the teaching of composition process. Both of my guests are distinguished composers, have music being played this week, and are distinguished teachers of composition as well. So Chris was educated at the Eastman School, Yale, and the University of Houston, and is now a professor at Yale University. I'm not going to go down the list of his prizes and awards, but a Rome Prize, the Guggenheim Prize, Prize from the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, the Master Prize, and many other good things. And Chris has also joined our faculty in Aspen as one of two permanent members of our composition faculty who are working with our young composers, and we'll get to that in a while. Daniel Kellogg was educated also at Yale University and at the Curtis Institute, and is now a professor at the University of Colorado in Boulder, a school with whom we have many close connections. Our archives are in Boulder. We have this year the largest number of students coming to us from the program in Boulder that we have had in my 12 summers here, which is in part testimony to the great work of the faculty there. So, welcome, Chris and Daniel. The work of Daniel's that we have coming up is a string quartet. It is actually the premiere of this piece. It is on Saturday, a concert beginning at 4:30 p.m. in Harris Concert Hall. And the Pacifica String Quartet will be playing this work, and indeed they commissioned the work, I believe.
Well, it was commissioned by a very good friend of them, specifically for them, so they were partnering in that.
Okay, great. And Chris has an orchestral work which opens our concert Sunday, July 30th, 4 p.m. in the Benedict Music Tent, and that is the Aspen Festival Orchestra, conducted by Robert Spano, our music director. And that piece has been played quite a bit all over the world, I think.
Right, yeah, as part of a consortium, the idea was to have a performance in every state, ranging from amateur orchestras and youth orchestras to professional-level orchestras. So I think it's been done by 58 orchestras now in the past year and a half, 2 years.
That's the Made in America program, or...?
Yes, it came out of the Made in America program. It's now called New Music for America, since it's left the orchestra leave.
Fantastic. So maybe let's start with that. The piece is called Dreamtime Ancestors, and I'd like you both to talk about the beginning of the compositional process. Does an ensemble come to you? Do you go to them? A commissioner has the idea? Do they have the idea for the piece in a highly specific way, or is it just, hey, Chris, how about an orchestra piece?
Right. So in this case, they are commissioning a new work every 2 years, essentially, that has this life, that it goes around and is performed in different parts of the country. And in order to do that, they want to find the most common kind of instrumentation that they can, because you may know that different scale orchestras might have triple winds as part of their major thing, so three oboes, three flutes. Some may only have two. Same thing with brass and so forth. So the basic starting point for this was a chamber orchestra, essentially, like a Haydn scale orchestra. So that was the first kind of restriction. The second one was that it was going to have to be played by all kinds of ranges of levels of orchestras. So that was a consideration. And then the third thing was that they want something approximately 20 minutes in length. Everything else is up to you. So that's the kind of starting point. And I had just done an enormous work for Robert and the Atlanta Symphony called Creation Creator that had a lot to do with creation stories and creation. And there was such an overflow of material for that. One of them was from the Aboriginal Australian creation myths. And so that became the starting point for my piece, which is called Dreamtime Ancestors.
Okay, so Creation Creator actually was first.
That's right.
And that was premiered, though, in the last season.
Right, that was 2015, yeah.
So when did you finish that piece, and when did you finish Dreamtime Ancestors?
So I finished Dreamtime Ancestors in the summer of 2015, and I had finished The Creation Creator at the end of 2014, basically.
Yeah. And although it's not our subject, it's such a fascinating piece. You say very large. How large, and what are the forces?
Of the
Creation Creator.
Yeah, so that was for the Atlanta Symphony Chorus, which is about 200 people or 250, depending on the year. The full orchestra and two narrators and five solo singers and video projections. It was a kind of a kitchen sink oratorio.
And so that's triple winds and four horns and...
Exactly, yeah.
How many percussionists?
There were three percussionists in timpani. So, yeah. Speaking of timpani, and then he walks.
So
he played it, actually.
So, but then, and material that became Dreamtime Ancestors, some of it is also in the earlier piece, or it's...
No, actually, originally it wasn't. I mean, I ended up absorbing the second movement called Rainbow Serpent back into the second iteration of Creation Creator, which happened this year when they went on tour to Kennedy Senator mm-hmm. and things like that. But yeah, it was not part of the original piece.
Right. And so, Dan, your piece, the commissioner came first and said, I want a piece for Pacifica, or I want a piece by you, or both?
So the commissioner, it's Richard Replin and Alyssa Stein, dear friends. They've been very good friends with Pacifica for a long time, and they love to travel and hear their favorite groups all over the world. So they had been trying to connect us for a few years and had hosted a dinner in their house when they were in Denver, and we got together and sort of said, would you two like to get together, almost like a matchmaker? And that was great for me. And over time, the group sort of got to know my music and said, yeah, we'd be very happy to go ahead with this. It's been a long time sort of in the making. So it's a little bit unusual in that sense. Rarely is a sort of individual trying to pair up a group and a composer, but that's how it happened.
And did they suggest a length, or did Pacifica, or...?
They were pretty open. They sort of said, look, if it's, 15 to 20 minutes, it's much easier to program, which I understand. But they didn't really have any restrictions, and I ended up writing, it's about 16 to 17 minute, a single movement piece that I've actually labeled String Quartet Number 1, even though I've written multiple pieces for string quartet before.
Uh-huh. And that's interesting to me. Is there something different in the form of it, or... Were there more narrative elements of other pieces, or what?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing when composers sort of harken back to labeling Symphony Number 1 or String Quartet Number 1. Many of us these days don't do that. We write lots of programmatic pieces or one-offs or tone poems, and many of my former string quartets are very driven by extra musical inspiration and any number of things, and that's how a lot of my music works. There was just something about where I was as a composer and my relationship to the string quartet that just felt like now is the time to write a string quartet number one. It's a very sort of rigorous, muscular piece in many ways, and it does not have a program. It doesn't have any extra musical inspiration, and I just felt like it was time for me to join the tradition of, I guess, doing that.
Okay. I'll make an aside that last week we had a seminar given actually in the same room on the concerto, and Chris was part of the panel. And most of us were observing that in the 19th century there were works called concerto, and then there were many works that are like concertos, Harold in Italy, say, the Scottish fantasy, say, where the composer is very specific in not calling it a concerto, and there really is a difference in those works. So... Interesting that this is a real quartet.
I hope so. Uh-huh.
So let's go then back to Chris. And Dan says his work has no program, but yours presumably does, because it originates in thinking about something which is not primarily musical.
That's right. I mean, it's always a kind of a dance that you have with the subject if you're doing something like that, and to what level you let it affect you. I mean, there are a number of people for which those metaphors become visual stimulus in a kind of filmic way, and then there are some... my own tendency is to kind of think of them as a spark or a starting point to spark some imaginative process. So in this case, the background of the Australian Dreamtime is that this is the oldest culture, continuous culture on Earth. It goes back to about 65,000 years for sure, and maybe as far back as 120,000 years ago. And it's the oldest continuous culture of art on Earth. So cave paintings and things like that go back 30,000 years that are still visible, which if you think about relationship to ancient Greece and ancient Egypt, eclipse that by tens of thousands of years. It's extraordinary. And so there are a number of things about the culture which I found amazingly attractive, but one of them was the sense of relationship to time. They have a kind of what they consider a parallel time to us, which is out of time. It is an eternal state that they call the dreaming, that everybody has access to. And it's the state in which all of your ancestors, all of your future and past is simultaneously existing. And you can access that state and have questions and talk to these forebears and so forth. And it's an amazing kind of idea. And there are other cultures that have this too. The ghost opera of Tandun, for instance, draws some connection to that in Chinese thinking. But it was very attractive to me as a starting point. So the piece, The Dreamtime Ancestors, kind of takes that as a starting point. And there are three movements. The first one is called Songlines. Songlines in that kind of cosmology is the idea that on the earth, all of these features of the earth, rivers, valleys, mountains, all came from our ancestors who created them and left them behind for us to be a part of. But specific places, so the places that mean the most to you as a lake, for instance, or something like that, your dreamtime ancestor made that place, and you're called to it for the rest of your life in the form of a songline singing to you to come back home and be a part. It's a beautiful idea. So for instance, just by way of example, the first movement that I have, the Songlines movement, takes a little bit of a literal kind of visual of that, of the kind of snaking of things being created. And from that central line that weaves throughout the whole movement, things kind of forms emerge from that, and shapes and melodies and things like that. So that's the way that, for instance, that's a starting point for me. It was just a kind of conceptual thing that allowed for a process to unfold in that movement.
So that unfolding, not to be overly particular about it, but it unfolds from the beginning. That is, you begin writing an idea and then another idea and then another idea, and it's an organic process as opposed to constructing the whole thing first.
I mean, every composer has really different ways of starting, you know, and I think all you have to do is teach for a few years to understand that, and it's really fantastic, the variety of kind of inception, the way things work. For me, I usually allow a couple of weeks of time where I'm just thinking about the kind of global idea and trying to come up with material that responds to that. And then I jot it down. And by the end of that period of kind of brainstorming, I have some things which feel like, okay, there's something there I'm drawn to. Let's use that as the starting point of the piece. And then I start linearly and working. So I have a pretty strong connection to whatever those essential materials are before I put the notes on the page, obviously. You discover things along the way, of course. But
and no doubt in your whole career, you have frequently done more abstract pieces that didn't have that kind of narrative or pictorial idea.
Yes, though I would say, I mean, I have, you know, I have a string quartet number 1-2 and a symphony number 1. It's you know, points of pride, but at the same time, I would say that they're not dissimilar processes for me, in the sense that there is usually something that I'm thinking about, whether or not it becomes integral enough to the idea that it would take on a title or even a program note is just, it's kind of, it, sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. So I do think in terms of metaphor a lot for starting points of pieces, and then, you know, they may be more or less connected to that actual thing.
Okay. So Dan, starting the string quartet, knowing only a rough length it will be, knowing the players for whom you're going to write it, where does your process go?
So I think there's actually a lot of similarities to what Chris was talking about, where there's an early period of mining or searching for ideas, building sort of a palette or a tapestry of things that I can pull from. In this particular piece, I had a clear idea before I began any part of it that I wanted the piece to begin with a very strong proclamation. a unison of sorts. It's not entirely unison, but it's a passage that sort of extends 90 seconds. And I worked in the very, very beginning to craft those core ideas. And actually, the first half of the piece was sort of workshop performed a few years ago, just the first half. And so I've even rewritten some of that, having heard that. I think that was 2 years ago. But a lot of the ideas flowed from that. And there was very much a discovery of what is the line or the DNA, the very core of this piece. Maybe there's a dance between me shaping the ideas and then discovering what the ideas are sort of telling me about themselves. And so although it is sort of an abstract thing that there isn't a single extra musical concept I could attach to the piece has a language and a grammar that's logical, coherent, that sort of poured out of that beginning idea. Something else that you said earlier that resonates again with this piece is, I feel like as composers, and certainly as artists, we're always going back to some of the same gestures or ideas from, not from former pieces, although of course they've shown up in former pieces that we've written, but they're somehow core to who we are as composers. And so in this piece, there's many things that I've pulled from other times I've written for string quartet, almost sort of saying, you know, in those several different pieces, I like that bit there. There was really something fantastic in that texture that I wanted to pull in. So there also was infusing some of those things, which I think is partly, again, why I may have called it String Quartet Number One, that it was building upon those other pieces.
Now, you've worked with some notable string quartets, especially Takash, which was also on their faculty in Boulder. Is there something different about writing for Pacifica or something particular?
Yes, absolutely. I think every quartet has their own personality, their own strengths. You know, at Takash, it was funny when they first commissioned me, I said, great, let's get a drink and talk about the piece. And so we just sat around and talked about what they liked and what they didn't like. And I had been hearing them live for several years because they perform locally all the time. And so I knew their personalities to a T. You know, I knew Andrasch could play this high G in the most beautiful way, and that became central. With Pacifica, I didn't have the same intimate knowledge of their playing, but I knew that they tackled thorny, complex music with ease. And not that that's what I was going after, but I knew that there was a freedom to have very muscular passages followed by intimate, tender passages, and to jump back and forth, to use that, their ability to play all kinds of music. That's a central part of this piece.
Well, I'm going to interject a process story because my teacher, Roger Sessions, had no method, first of all. So when we get to this, and I want to pick up from what you said, Chris, already, no prescription to give. But he advised students, it's really good to have as sharp a musical image about something in the piece as possible. And he would say, wait for it. And get it as clear in your mind, and it might be everything. It might be the exact pitches, the exact registration, the exact instrumentation, or it might be just a feeling. And then he said, bonus points if it's going to happen about between half and two-thirds of the way through the piece. Then begin at the beginning and aim at that. Then be ready to totally fail and to not hit the mark at all, and have it be a totally other piece. So he said, you may end up with three or four pieces worth of stuff because you never get to the thing you wanted.
I think, you know, in a similar vein, you know, one of my teachers was Sam Adler. The first time I came in for a lesson with him, I brought in this thing which was kind of Indian inspired, you know, and it was a kind of a rag melody. And he goes, no, what are you doing? You've ruined it. And I was like, how do you know? I just started. And he was like, no, you really, he said, this is really a beautiful melody. And you just panted it to us, this beautifully cooked thing right in front of our face without any preparation. He said, what you need to do is compose backwards now. You know, in other words, like you said, you know something and you focus on it in a way that when you hand it, it's like the most precious thing in the world. I was thinking last night about the beautiful last movement of the Mahler in the Michel de Young concert, that somehow at that moment, the very end of all of this sumptuous second half pieces, that it's just, it comes and it hits you just at that most dramatic moment. And it's like set up almost by the Duparc and the other four movements of the Mahler in such a special way. And I think there's a lot of that. And I've often thought about composing backwards equally. And it's certainly part of my editing process too, if I feel like I've gotten someplace too soon or too without enough meaning.
Well, I will say, and it's I say this with a little tinge of sadness because it's too late for you to have heard Michelle de Young's concert last night. But this was a recital program. She involved string quartet, piano, and voice, but highly designed. And she came to us about 18 months ago saying, I really want to do this recital. But indeed, the DuParc that opened the second half were specifically chosen to set up the last song of the Rückert Lieder. And so you were definitely onto something there. Here's just a related story about Roger Sessions. And it's sort of an insider story, but his first piano sonata, he began with this ringing chord in his ears. And he said he kept going for walks and kept refining to make sure he had it down before he got to paper. And then he wrote it down, and that was going to be the opening sound of this piano sonata. And he began writing after it. And he said only weeks in did he realize that it needed to be set up. And there's this, when you hear the finished piece, there's this gorgeous opening that has no relation. And then when that chord rings, it's just the perfect thing. So it's impossible to imagine what the piece would have sounded like if it had opened with that chord in the end. Let's go back to Dreamtime Ancestors then and maybe see a little bit.
Absolutely, sure. Yeah. So I brought four pictures and a 1 minute and a half audio clip from the piece. So as I was mentioning, you know, a lot of this, the cave art that goes back 30,000 years that's still around, most of it's in Western Australia and Northern Australia. But these are some examples from about 8,000 years ago, 6,000 to 8,000 years ago that you'll see, and they're quite florid and amazing looking, but they have a lot of the archetypal imagery and some of the, you know, as you may know, around Australia, there are many different iterations of indigenous peoples, okay? So they have many different kind of regional gods and regional Dreamtime ancestors and that kind of thing, but they share a few in common, which is kind of an interesting thing. So you can see how complex, and if you're sitting farther back, maybe it's not so clear, but maybe we can see the next one. This is one of the main figures that's common to all of the Aboriginal people in Australia. It's called Rainbow Serpent. And this is from about 8,000 years ago. And Rainbow Serpent is the figures prominently as the second movement of my piece. Rainbow Serpent is the one that carves particularly the rivers and valleys, and in its wake leaves rainbows and stars. So it had figured greatly in kind of forming the surface of the earth. And I'll explain more about how that figures into my second movement in particular in a minute, and we'll hear that excerpt. The next slide, that is Kakadu, who is a major figure also common to most of the, Aboriginal peoples, also from about the same time. This is the Zeus figure of this cosmology. His name is Bayame, and he's the original being that forms all of the other dream and summons all of the other Dreamtime ancestors and sends them out into the world and universe to create. And so those are the kind of four images from cave art going back many thousand years to give you some kind of sense of that, which is quite beautiful. So shall I keep talking? I could do something about the Rainbow Serpent, which is Rainbow Serpent is the title of the second movement of my piece. One of the things I've done a lot and have been quite interested in coming out of our, were you working with Jacob Darkerman?
Or
you
was just I actually took one lesson with him in 1995, yeah. His last summer here, but he had passed before I went to Yale.
Yeah, so he was a very influential teacher at Yale and kind of brought together many different styles and started to break down barriers between different kinds of voices. Very, very unique figure in a lot of ways. But one of the things he did in his orchestration was compose what he called orchestra with the pedal down, meaning that there's these beautiful sounds. If in the pedal, you know, on the piano, you press it down, it creates this great sustain. And so he, using that, became very important to me. I love the sets of the spectrum of wet to dry in the orchestra and tried to build that in. And so in this movement, Rainbow Serpent, which seemed like a perfect metaphor for that, in the wake of what was being created, there were these halos kind of being left behind in the form of a rainbow or starscape and so forth. So what you'll hear is the opening minute and a half, which is just this weaving line that has a certain kind of resonance built in. And the way I do that is the first violins and half of the cellos are playing the main melodic line. The rest of the string orchestra, and this is mostly a string orchestra featured movement, leaves kind of little sustained notes, a little longer than the rest of the melody, so that what you get is like if you were singing in a cathedral or something like that, the sound kind of hangs in the air a little bit longer, and it's built into the orchestration. And further, this is helped by certain kinds of sustain instruments that are transparent, which is also something from Jacob he did, with vibraphone, piano, harp, that kind of complex where you have a natural sustain, but it's not a thick wall. So let's hear the opening minute and a half of the second movement, Rainbow Serpent. So that's the
beautiful. So, if I'm getting it right, yes. The thought image, or the actual visual image, but more the idea behind it of the rainbow serpent, leads you to a sonic image of the sound being carried that way, and then that impels the whole.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think it in this case is probably a little bit more literal in some ways than the like the last movement, which is mm-hmm. more of a feeling response to something. Uh-huh. Exactly.
Great. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot, Dan, with the following highly prescriptive question. When we're thinking about program notes, which of course at the festival and school we think about a lot. And also when I'm talking with young composers who have the task of either standing up on stage and speaking about their music or writing a note that will help an audience, I often say, try to limit the number of things you say and try not to say, then a French augmented sixth chord leads to the unexpected key of F sharp minor. And try to give people something that when they read it or hear it, and then they hear the piece, they'll go, oh, that's what she was talking about. So with that preamble, what one or two things would you say about your piece to an audience if we were just about to hear it?
Because it is not a piece with a specific program, I would say that there's an urgency and a yearning that's captured in the piece. And it's hopefully pushing towards some sort of an ecstatic experience. And so it actually is saying something very specific, but it's something that I couldn't articulate in words, but something that I have had a deep need to express musically. So I want the piece to grab you with its proclamation in the beginning, this promise that something important is being explored. And then the piece sort of pulls back and goes inside, and it has yearning and sort of grinding of teeth. and then gradually moves towards hopefully some bit of ecstasy and peace.
Okay, perfect. So that's an emotional roadmap.
Yes.
What if I said, now you can't do that, so okay. Now you need to give me a musical, technical roadmap, but that won't confuse me?
The piece has moments of homophonic writing where everyone is playing together with the same rhythms, the same unified expression. And then it has lots of contrapuntal passages, and especially moments of canon, not very literal canons, but the idea where ideas are pulling from the same material but overlapped and spinning out almost in circles around each other. And much of the piece is a balance between those two kinds of ideas, this idea of unified expression where four individuals are combining forces to say something at the same moment, and moments where they're not necessarily antagonistic towards each other, but where they're in counterpoint or in opposite playing with each other.
Okay. So I don't know how you all feel, but that makes me, the two things make me really want to hear the piece.
Thanks.
And make me believe that I will hear something in it instead of it just sort of all happening. So that's good. I want to ask you, Chris, a rather pointed question, but I mean it without any pointedness. This is about the topic of appropriation. And in some sectors of American cultural life, this is a very hot topic. Chris's colleague, Stephen Hartke, who was here for the first 4 weeks of the summer, was telling me about an experience. He wrote a piece that we've actually presented here in Aspen as well called Oh, Them Rats Is Mean in My Kitchen. And the piece is based on an actual blues composition and uses it in a really significant way. I think it's a fantastic piece, by the way. But it was being presented at a college campus, and there was actual protest that, I hope he won't mind my calling him this, a middle-aged white male composer was appropriating a very specific cultural element, not his own, and making it part of his piece. So what would you say if confronted with that?
It comes up a lot, and it comes up a lot in universities. I mean, maybe you've had this conversation with students at the university where you're at, and I have too, and many of the universities I've been at. And, you know, it's a sensitivity thing, of course, and it's important. It's an important angle to think about and to consider when you're doing something and not just blindly rush forward into whatever sounds cool and that kind of thing. I mean, I think there are a couple of things for me I think about when I'm doing something like that. One, is it a genuine interest? I mean, am I doing it because it's a flashy idea, or is it something that I'm actually genuinely interested? The whole idea of this for me came from a trip to Western Australia and seeing some of the cave art originally. That set the seed for me in the long run thinking about this, so that when I started doing Creation Creator, it came back to the fore and I started thinking more seriously about it. So I think, you know, starting from a standpoint of I'm really genuinely interested in this subject. And then second, I would say, you know, when you start thinking about appropriation, I mean, are we appropriating European music here at the Aspen Music Festival, at Yale University, at different places? I mean, at what level do you take appropriation as being problematic? It's been distilled enough in generations past that things seem less like that. So, I mean, I think about these things, but, you know, at some level, you have to say, well, I want to do this because, not because it's sensational, but because this is a beautiful subject. It's a beautiful idea. It has things that inspire me creatively, and I would defend that. You know, this piece, Dreamtime Ancestors, in Charlottesville, when it was done there by the symphony, it turns out that the only Australian Aboriginal Museum in North America is based in Charlottesville. And immediately they were bristling at the idea of this piece having to do that. And I was back and forth correspondence with the curator of the museum and her complaints were very specific. They were about the terminology, dreamtime versus dreaming versus very specific things about the way I'd referenced Rainbow Serpent and that kind of thing. So, you know, some people have a mentality of wanting to get the precision of the vocabulary right and want a certain level of precision and almost scholarly approach to something for it to be justifiable. For me, again, because I think in metaphor, there's a limit at which the specificity is not poetry anymore. It's research knowledge. And that's very interesting, and I like that stuff too. But that will not enter into my composition because it doesn't translate in a way in that way. So, you know, those are the things that I think about when I'm thinking about this issue of appropriation. I'm aware of it for sure. You know, I mean, it's something that, you know, you go into and you confront. I mean, this stuff comes up, you know, and people are suspicious by nature. So if it smells funny, they're like, why are you doing that? You know, I love that piece of Stevens. And that was one of the first pieces I've heard of his and thought it was amazing. And it didn't occur to me that because he loved the Delta Mississippi blues, that was going to get him in trouble. But,
Well, if you come to the concert Sunday, which will open with Chris's piece, and if you don't leave right away, you will hear a new piece by me, a piano concerto, which is the second piece on the concert. And this piece is about singing, and it quotes a great German chorale tune, generally called Saint Anne, and a tune that's been used by many, many composers. It's a gigantic Bach prelude and fugue called Saint Anne, based on this tune. Then later it has a Louis Armstrong song, Someday You'll Be Sorry, words and music by Louis Armstrong, uniquely, and an African-American spiritual, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, which in my imagination, although I have no research proof whatsoever of this, Louis Armstrong based his melody on in a very curious way. So I'm wondering if people will say, well, you can use Saint Anne because it's a Protestant chorale tune, but you can't use an African-American spiritual. And then would you say to a Chinese-born composer, you know, you should not be using Saint Anne, which is clearly not part of your culture. So
I was going to jump in and say, I think they're very serious questions, but at some point, we all have our musical identities, which go back to, you know, the first singing we ever heard or what we heard as a child. And any individual is going to have 20 things that fit into that box. And it seems like, you know, we add to that box of what makes up our identity as we go through life. And any of that's fair game, so long as you say it's an authentic expression. And you know, if there's homage paid, if you're taking these things as beautiful objects, I don't know. I guess I just chuckle because I think they are real issues that need to be asked. But at one level, in a global world where things are shrinking and the internet is available, we travel over the place, every musical interaction we have should somehow come into our music at some point in our lives. I mean, not in very specific ways, sometimes very specific. So anyway.
And I would further add that the point is not the moniker or the cultural reference, actually, in the end. The point is the music. I mean, we're actually trying to get to Dan's piece, the abstract composition that doesn't need bolstering by a nice title, you know. I mean, we're trying to get to that, essentially, a primary experience of musical connection. And the sparks of these other things are, I think, a good, basically, taken in consideration that, yes, you know, if you're trying desperately, like I spent last week before I came here, a week in the Navajo Nation. I'd never done that before. It was an amazing experience. But one of the things I encountered talking to several Navajo people, and some very, very traditional, was how mixed the identity was. And in a way, a lot of the people who were in the Navajo Nation are looking forward and not looking backwards at their own traditions and their own ancestry. And it's a kind of a reverse problem for classical music. I mean, we're so attached to our tradition that looking forward is actually not, is a secondary thing sometimes. And I was kind of thinking about this idea of like the richness of somebody really wanting to pay attention to something, but then when they put it out there, they may be putting it out in misinformation, which I think is the fear behind people actually raising a protest about somebody using the Dreaming or whatever, an African-American spiritual or something like that, is that fear of losing that original core and it becoming something else that wasn't, you know, like rock and roll. You know, the history of rock and roll is full of those kind of questions. But what gets lost and what gets found and what becomes, what evolves. So I also treat it with respect. I think it's an important question, and I'm sensitive if somebody says that. I'm genuinely sorry that if it affects them that way. And yet I think the greater good is that the creative process is about inspiration.
Well, here's a story that I think is relevant, and especially to the way you put it, Dan, about one's own personal history with respect to tradition. And there's a very, very brilliant essay by T.S. Eliot called Tradition and the Individual Talent that also riffs on some of this stuff. But I was at a musical meeting in Bucharest, and we were told by the organizers that we were going to have a fantastic musical treat. They were going to bus us out to a monastery which had a tradition of singing unbroken for something like 1,700 years. And this is a Christian sect which is not Roman Catholic and is not Orthodox. It had its own history that goes all the way back to the Roman Empire itself. So we were all excited. Monastery, super beautiful. Choir, all men, came in and began singing. It was, and they had emphasized, that is, our guides had emphasized, this is a tradition unchanged in 1,700 years. It has been preserved and handed down. We were just thinking, oh my goodness, what is it going to sound like? Well, it sounded like a phenomenon from a few years ago, if you remember the Bulgarian, the mystery of the Bulgarian women's choirs. So they were singing in harmony, and in harmony that sounded pretty modern to me. It was very beautiful. The tonal production was different from any other kinds of singing, but like the Bulgarian women, that have their own tonal production. And so I'm sitting there thinking, so there was harmony in the year 300 AD. So I went up to the music master afterwards, and I said, well, just tell me about this tradition. Like, where did you get, do you sing from notation, or is it an oral tradition? He said, oh, no, I write everything down. I said, oh, you write everything down? He said, yes, well, these are my compositions. I said, oh, so this music wasn't sung in the year 300? And he just looked at me like, how can you be so ridiculous? He said, of course not. And I said, okay, so what about the tradition? He said, well, yes, I mean, I grew up in this tradition, and now this is the music I make. So, I don't know where we can go from there, but... let's think for a minute about teaching, and we did not prepare this, but I wonder, you've mentioned something about Druckmann and an insight that was very resonant and important for you in this composition. Can you tell us some other happy stories about a teaching experience where you were the student?
Oh, gosh, sure. One thought that has stayed with me for a long time is something that Martin Bresnik said. So Martin Bresnik is sort of a long teacher at Yale and a big figure in the world of teaching composition. And we were talking about repetition and an idea coming back in musical memory. And he said, Dan, I don't think you should ever have a literal repetition. I think that there's always a chance to be tweaking and changing and having an idea evolve and change. And that, even on a subconscious level, will pull the listener in. And I don't know that I entirely agree with it, but it was one of those moments where he opened up a world of thinking that I'm still wrestling with, which is, what is it to have material return in a piece? How does it return? How familiar is it? Can you have repetition? And I use that line always with my students. I don't say you have to always avoid little repetition, but it's something that needs to be thought about in very profound levels. So that was Martin Bresnik.
Okay, beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I think that those are the ones that actually you refer to for the rest of your life. You know, there are things that you struggle against, you agree with at certain moments, you come back and you say, why did he say that? That's a terrible thing to say. I mean, and they become reference points, which are actually some of the best things you can do for a student is give them those things to respond to. You know, Sam Adler telling me to compose backwards and those kind of comments. And then, you know, I do believe that music has a mechanics to it. And, you know, you have to be sensitive as a teacher that when somebody's presenting something to you, that they have their own laws, their own gravity, their own grammar, and you're trying to understand that so that you can make instructive comments specifically within their language to do that. And I'm a big believer in the specificity of things. Some composer teachers kind of stay at the level of concept, but I think they both work. There's a reason why things work and don't work sometimes timing-wise, but it depends on what somebody wants, obviously. So I try to get involved in that. And I think the other thing as a teacher is that you have to realize that you're part of somebody's solution. You're not their solution. And you don't want to be their solution because an artist is not made up of another person completely. It's really you're a fraction of their identity in some way in terms of thinking and ways of thinking. And so being around an environment in which you're part of that ecosystem in which they observe and they say, maybe they refer to 10 years down the line, something that happened in a particular setting, you know, that they didn't think about until that moment. So that's the kind of thinking that I think holistically that kind of helps as a teacher of the arts. I mean, you're not trying to impose, you're really trying to help somebody get up into their own orbit and figure out what they're about.
So are there things, I'll ask each of you in turn, that you are aware that you are likely to say to every student at some point or not?
Be nice. That's the first thing. I mean, I think that, you know, that idea of, you know, the now more than ever, I mean, the diversity of voices is such that if you have any proprietary sense of what you're doing as being very, very important, that you are become dismissive of the next person to you. And partly it's figuring out how to play well together in that kind of context. But besides that, no.
Gosh. It's funny because there are many moments in lessons where a student sort of smiles at me and I realize that I've suddenly said something that I probably said 3 weeks ago, or that I might even have hit the same note and said, I'm not sure this B flat is right here. And they said, yeah, you told me that 3 weeks ago. So there's a consistency. But that doesn't quite answer your question. I always want to ask them about process. I want to ask them to dig deeper into their ideas. I find that it's very easy for composers to be too easily satisfied. I used easy twice in that sentence. That we can go to finding our ideas and find something that we think is good and stop. And I think that that's especially true for younger students. So I always want to try to push them. Yes, this is a nice melody, or this is a nice motive, or this is a good beginning idea, but I wonder if there's something that's even stronger. So I get to that a lot in my lessons.
Do you think, now this is a thought experiment, it can only be one, but do you think your students perceive there are things you tell all of your students?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Because when I went to study with Roger Sessions, he was a fabulous teacher, but he was a really difficult one, and he typically had only two students at a time. And all of his past students were in a sort of network that helped whoever the two current ones were. And the two primary coaches I had that first year were Ellen Zwillich and John Harbison. And they would come take the two of us to lunch, and sometimes they would say, has he said this yet?
I think there are things that you, as people, as human beings, we're naturally super drawn to. So for me, details of orchestration are just endlessly fascinating. Like tinkering with sound is great. And hearing Milton Babbitt talk about pitch manipulation is exciting to me because he made it really clear and exciting to listen to, but it's not where my mind wants to go most of the time. So if a student comes into me who's very pitch-oriented and constructivist in that sense, I struggle with metaphors and things that will help kind of probe the origins of that and what's valuable and what's not valuable more than I do. So the kind of comments that some student might hear from me on orchestration, another student may hear those similar kinds of things because those are the things which practically occupy my mind a lot of the time, proportionally. And I think that those are the kinds of things that I think students would perceive coming back.
So you would definitely talk about orchestration and principles of orchestration or experiences of it with students. I venture to say we all would. And especially with Sam Adler as one of your teachers, because he's the master, would you talk about more purely theoretical things with a student?
Yeah, I mean, I'm genuinely concept driven. So at the conceptual level, I do a lot of back and forth with that. And I mean, I think the thing you realize, I mean, I realize anyway, maybe I shouldn't speak for anybody else, is that Socratically getting someplace with a student is much better than telling them something and then them taking it on face value. In other words, I rarely will make a specific comment about orchestration, for instance, or a concept or something like that, without getting to something behind it that's essential, you know, a reason for doing something like that. And I think if they get that, that's the most important thing. So concept is really super important. Structure is, but structure as a real-time experiential thing and not as an abstract architecture, things like that.
Okay. I want to pause to give a commercial. So our composition program here, which has been an important program in American musical life since the early 50s, and Dan was a student here, has evolved into the following. We have 10 young composers who come each summer. They now come for the whole summer, which was not always true. They can theoretically be of any age, although we might get into that, what has happened with your choices this summer. They are chosen by a very competitive interview, audition, application process. This summer, it was the most competitive of all of our programs. Surpassing conducting, which is really unusual. Stephen Hartke and Chris Stefanidis are together making those choices. So, but once they're here, each of those 10 composers, well, let me back up. Each of the 10 is asked to compose a brief piece for orchestra for the summer. And then when they come, they are paired with a student conductor. And then our conducting academy orchestra will work with them, and we will have a reading with rehearsal time and ending up with a recording of that brief piece with the student conductor conducting the conducting academy orchestra and the composition faculty and any guest composers who are present in that time giving comments. Then the composition faculty will choose from the 10. This summer we chose 4. And we will give them another shot at hearing their piece with full orchestra, but this time with some very specific critique. And they're asked to present alternatives responding to a critique. And the critique might be something about orchestration, about thickness or thinness or transparency. It might be something about repetition. This would benefit if it were longer. This would benefit if it were shorter, perhaps. But they will come into that reading with at least 2 versions of certain things, and then the audience, which will include the composers and conductors, will listen to it. We've been doing this a couple of summers. It's, to me, one of the most interesting things of the whole summer. Almost no one comes to it, which is why I'm telling you. It is going to be August 12th, Saturday morning, 9 to 12 in Harris Hall. It is free. You don't need a pass. You don't need anything. Just walk in. Bring all your friends. And I guarantee you, you'll have a really interesting time. So, Chris, since you have now been preparing what we'll be asking those composers to do, I don't know if you have any further comment on the process.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, what each person is kind of struggling with is different. You know, in some cases, the students are doing little miniature experiments, so they're not focusing on the flow of a 10-minute piece, let's say. And so there are structural things that are you don't have to worry about with that kind of approach. And then there are some which, you know, you really feel like they almost got it, but the pacing is a little bit off or something like that. And, you know, what happens if, like you said, maybe we expand this section, we shorten this a little bit. You know, and those things are, in miniature, there are probably 3 or 4 in each of the pieces that they're going to try a couple of different ways. And in some cases, not just one different way, but like 3 or 4, and you hear them back to back and see what the effect of that is. And it's kind of neat because it's a real thing. I mean, you can tell right on the spot. Version number 3 works the best, you know, in this context, and develop an opinion about it.
And not an experience so many composers get to hear the actual thing and to be able to respond to it.
And that, I think, comes from Robert Spano especially. I mean, he does this in Atlanta, where he'll a particularly slow week, he'll give an entire service to developing and playing something in progress so that the composer can hear and make changes and make it better. Because in the actual professional world, you might have two rehearsals and a dress, and the amount of time you get on each of these rehearsals is so thin, you're panicky, you don't have time to make adjustments.
Yeah, so remember, Composer Workshop, or the calendar calls it Composer Showcase, August 12th, 9 a.m. in Harris Hall. I think we have time if there are questions or comments from the audience, and wait for the microphone and it will come right down here.
Little bitty question. Do the composers play any instruments?
I think we have all played instruments. I'm a product of the public school system music program in Connecticut. So I played violin, viola, double bass, electric bass, jazz bass, sang in the choirs, learned a little bit of conducting. Did none of it well. I did it okay, but I got a great, well-rounded education through the public school system playing lots of instruments.
And I would say, just anecdotally, that maybe a third of the students who I've taught play really high-level instrument. They play extremely well. And most of them do some instrument reasonably well. I kind of fall in the second category myself. I'm a kind of failed pianist. But if I had been a better pianist, maybe I wouldn't have started composing. So I'm happy that I ended up. But and you have a different exposure with different things. So I played oboe for a dozen years. Played up to third position violin and, just very limited other instruments. So I had some working knowledge of different families and that kind of thing.
About the 10 that are here now.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I think...
Many of them play very well, yeah. I'm thinking several of them actually perform as instrumentalists, yeah.
I think most of us as teachers encourage students to keep up their chops as much as possible. It does so many wonderful things for a young composer. It gives you credibility. It gives you firsthand experience. It even practically maybe helps you with gigs when you're just out of school trying to make things work. It's a wonderful asset to be an active performer.
First of all, I just want to thank you. This has been a wonderful discussion, and you all not only can you compose with notes, the way you compose with words and explanations is just beautiful. So thank you. What I want to say, it's going to sound a little peculiar, but I had an association based on the creative process that you talked about. A few years ago, there was a Picasso exhibit. I think it was at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, something like that, or the Metropolitan. I don't remember which museum at this point. But they claim that Picasso said, "A good artist copies and a great artist steals." Any reactions to that?
Well, I could start, but I don't think I should finish. I'll reframe it a little bit in the sense that I think if an artist sees something that works so well that they latch onto it with real specificity, they want to understand why that moment does something for them in that way. Maybe that's about as close to stealing as we get. I mean, it's kind of an enthusiasm. I mean, I don't think it's vainglorious. I don't think people are doing it. Like in Stravinsky's case, he hid a number of his own stealings. I mean, he actually, took things quite literally in some cases, but then denied that. I mean, there are certain role models like Jurgi Ligeti, for example, who, when he discovered the music of Kanlan Nankaro, he actually talked about it a lot in his own public way. He was able to say, this guy Nankaro really has influenced me in this, that, and that, and I would draw your attention to this. And that's the model, I think, is the way to go. Because if there's somebody who's that essential to your development, you don't want to claim credit for it. It's just not polite, But I think that the idea of stealing, it's kind of a nomenclature thing versus copying. I'm not sure really what that is. I mean, I think part of it is just being aware that we're composites of things, and sometimes those have very specific starting points.
I will say, just as a funny anecdote, I'd written a concerto, and I said to the soloist at one point, I didn't even know why, I said, well, the Stravinsky quote, that's in there. And then the soloist said, no, what? And I said, well, if you don't know, then I'm not telling you. And it was from the violin concerto, by the way. And then he went on an excavation and kept coming back with, I found it. And he came up with about 13 different Stravinsky quotes that were in my piece, none of which were intentional or known to me. But every one of them, what he said, I said, oh, it is like that.
Yeah, I was going to add that any artist should be a mad consumer of other people's art, whether it's music or literature or anything else. And you're going to absorb all kinds of things. And occasionally we're going to literally quote and we'll own up to it, and that's a homage or that's a specific device. But often great music just hopefully affects us, and we're all standing on the people that came before us and how they treated the art form.
Now, let's see if we have time for Tom. I had one, I think.
What's the role of the commissioner as to the commissionee?
So I think you heard the question, that what's the role of the commissioner to the commissionee? I think it's always different. It could be any number of things. If it's somebody that's a real serious connoisseur of the art form, there could be a real dialogue about what's being created. Sometimes it might be a specific thing. I really would love to write something, have you write something in memory of my mother, and she loved this melody, and does that resonate with you? Or it could be as simple as, in my case, was, I want you to write a string quartet, Dan, for one of the great string quartets in the world. Write what you write. Write what you want, write something great. It could be anything along that spectrum.
Have you ever had a commissioning idea that you just thought, no, I don't want to do that?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Would you like to relate or no?
Yeah, I could relate, actually. It's kind of a lot of the forms that this take is not so much, would you write a bassoon concerto or something like that? It's more like, I have this friend who's a poet, and I'd really like to do something with countertenor in this poet's music, poet's words. And they send, and I'm totally game to look at anything. I mean, if somebody wants to do that, I look at it. But it's a little bit awkward because you can't just set any poetry. It has to mean something to you. So those are the text-based things tend to be the most problematic for me personally, not the actual assignment of the instrumentation or something else.
Okay. Now, I fear we have overstayed our hour, so I do want to just remind you again, and the listening audience at home, 4:30 p.m. Saturday, July 29th in Harris Hall. It's a mixed chamber music program, but with Pacifica Quartet playing Dan Kellogg's new piece. And then Sunday afternoon, 4 p.m., July 30, Aspen Festival Orchestra opening with Chris Theophanides' Dreamtime Ancestors. Thanks.
And then followed by the premiere of your concerto.
Yeah, and then followed by my piece.